Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. As this afternoon, September 24, 2020, we're pleased to host this event sponsored by our intellectual property practice group called Patent Litigation in the Western District of Texas, an afternoon discussion with Judge Alan Albright, and a new take on patent case procedures. My name is Nick Marr. I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts. I'll introduce first Judge Ryan Holt. He's a federal judge on the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. He'll introduce our other speakers, who will then have a discussion on patent rules and new developments. Towards the end, we'll open it up for audience question and answer, so be thinking of your questions for when we get to that portion of the call. Okay, Judge Holt, thanks for being with us here today. The floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Nick. And it's my pleasure to begin this call, and I will try to move through these bios quickly in order to make sure that we have ample time for our excellent discussion. Our first participant is a great friend and mentor of mine for a number of years now. Judge Alan Albright is a federal district judge for the Western District of Texas, Waco Division. Judge Albright was nominated by President Trump in January of 2018, confirmed, and was sworn in September of 2018. Prior to taking the bench, Judge Albright was a partner in the Austin office of Bracewell LLP. He practiced IP litigation and handled trials in both federal courts and the ITC. Before practicing law in Austin, he earned a BA in political science from Trinity University in San Antonio and a JD from the University of Texas School of Law in Austin, where he was a member of the Texas Law Review. Following law school, Judge Albright clerked for the Honorable James Nolan in Austin, Texas. Judge Albright later served as a United States Magistrate Judge from 1992 to 1999. He's taught classes as an adjunct professor at the University of Texas School of Law, was recently inducted into the American College of Trial Lawyers, and on a personal note, he has two sons and is an avid runner and cyclist. And I'll just note at the onset that I'm especially looking forward to more background on a discussion related to his patent rules in a handful of cases that I've had on my docket now when parties seemingly cannot agree on anything in their patent litigation. I've suggested Judge Albright's case management rules and his procedures as a guide for their case, and that received overwhelming support from both sides. So this will be a great discussion. Our second panelist is another good friend of mine, Arthur Gollwitzer, a partner in Michael Best's Austin office and the immediate past managing partner of that office. His practice concentrates on intellectual property litigation, as well as internal investigations, False Claims Act suits, partnership and breach of fiduciary duty and breach of contract matters. Art writes and speaks frequently on a wide range of topics from the Boston bomber to patent litigation reform, as well as local patent rules, which we'll discuss as part of this event this afternoon. Prior to joining Michael Best, Art served as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York, where he was the lead prosecutor in criminal trials, including federal intellectual property crimes. With that, I'll hand things over to Art, and I'll come back in about 30 minutes in order to make sure that we can ask Art some questions before I field questions from the audience at the end. Art?
Thank you, and thank you, Judge Albright, for joining us. As we just heard, we've just passed the two-year anniversary of your taking the bench, and in that time, your courtroom has become the busiest court in the country. I think that's based on 2020 filings. You're at the top of the list, and people are taking note. I see repeated articles in Law 360 and elsewhere regarding best practices in your courtroom, what lawyers can expect, etc. So the introduction or to this program refers to or attributes this success to a unique brand of local patent rules. Do you agree that you've created something new and different? And if so, what are your goals?
Well, I will tell you, I think the second or third time I got interviewed and was asked the question about why patent filings had increased to some degree in the Western Division, and asked me what I attributed that to, I jokingly said it's because I'm so awesome And I thought the reporter would understand that was a joke, but he quoted me directly in that article. So I try to be a little more judicial in what I say. I would frankly give all the credit to people other than myself, really. I'll start with my law clerks. I have an exceptional law clerk who has a PhD, EE, and he'll be succeeded by someone with a similar technological background in the new year, who works tirelessly. We are able to mind meld. And my other law clerks, I have a substantial number of civil cases, only half of which are patent. And my other law clerks keep us from drowning with the non-patent cases. So I'm unbelievably blessed to have law clerks, great law clerks. The other thing that I did, and I, when history is written about my judgeship, I sure wish I could remember why I did this. I don't know why I did, but I knew going in that one of the things I liked the very best about the Eastern District patent practice was that if I wanted to file a suit there, or if one of my clients got sued there, there was such great certainty of when things would happen. I thought having rules that lawyers could give their clients that kind of certainty would be very beneficial. And so I put together an ad hoc committee, which I'm pretty sure there's no doubt you're on. But I put together a committee of lawyers that is open to anyone on the call to join as well. And my goal was pretty simple. I wanted to come up with a default schedule and other procedures, and it's morphed into protective orders and other issues now. But I wanted to come up with a procedure that was that would be viewed by both sides as being so fair that they would either decide, okay, this is a good default, or if they wanted to deviate from it, they could do so because it fit the case without feeling like they were giving up some benefit that the scheduling order offered to one side or the other. So the committee was made up intentionally of, I thought, just absolutely wonderful patent litigation attorneys of every stripe. If people represented large defendants, if people represented small defendants, if they were at a big law firm, if they were at a small law firm, if they worked suing on large patent cases by the hour, or if they worked for non-practicing entities, I wanted as much representation from every facet of patent litigation as I could get, because I wanted them to negotiate a scheduling order that everyone would think would be fair. I'll give you a specific example. In my career, I probably handled roughly 60% defense cases, 40% plaintiff. But if you break down my trials, I had over a dozen patent trials, and I think that was almost an exact 50-50 split. So I had a pretty good idea of what both sides was interested in. And one of the concerns that almost every defense counsel raised with me, a generic concern, was over the length of time that they had to do the original invalidity contentions. And so, kind of in the bargaining process of the scheduling order, I made sure that, that period of time was sufficient to satisfy the vast majority, if not all, of the defense lawyers who were participating on the committee. And it was that kind of buy-in, I thought, that was very, very beneficial. It turned out to be a real, and I'm not saying it was brilliant because I came up with it. I'm not sure that I was the one who thought up the idea of doing it that way, but it's turned out to be a really great deal, because what it allows parties to do now, by and large, with the exception of, the 1% case that falls out of the norm, basically allows the attorneys to get together, figure out when a Markman, the Markman date in my scheduling order would work best for them. They contact my law clerk and see when we're free on the schedule to have one. And then, you know, the other dates, by and large, fall pretty much before and after that. And then people know that they're going to be going to trial in my court, or typically they would know, and I think it's in my local rules, it's sort of a warning that I have, for example, a Markman tomorrow in a case. I don't know if I've entered a trial date or not, but that trial will be going to trial before the end of next year. So roughly, 12 to 16 months after the Markman, I'll be setting it for jury trial. And that's very standard in my court. And hopefully all of that has helped in terms of if someone like you gets a client who comes in and they say, where should we file? What'll happen if we file in Waco as compared to other places? Or if someone comes in and says, we've been sued in Waco, how does this compare to what happens in other courts where we've been sued? Lawyers should pretty easily be able to predict for them what will happen.
In your 2 years on the bench, as you've sort of moved towards those goals in the notoriety of your district has your practices has increased, are there any misperceptions out there that you'd like to correct? Is there anything that you think is misunderstood or exaggerated about how things go in your courtroom?
I think one thing that concerns me is that occasionally I will read people who write articles about what we're doing here and intimate that this is in any way what might be thought of as a plaintiff's court. Again, I wasn't an entirely plaintiff's lawyer on the patent side. To the contrary, at every opportunity I've been given to speak publicly like this, whatever I've done, I've tried to make it clear that when I got on the bench, it was not that long after T.C. Hartland had been decided, and there was some shift of cases, in different places. And what I perceived was because of T.C. Hartland, it seemed to me that Delaware and California were getting swamped. And my vision was not to compete with any other district. I think I've got a lifetime job. I'm going to get, it doesn't matter in that regard. What I perceived myself as doing was if I could create a venue that lawyers who did patent litigation found acceptable, then that would be, and there are not a lot of divisions throughout the United States who have judges who have a lot of patent experience. And my goal was to make it so that this year in Delaware, instead of them getting 1,000 cases because they're Delaware, my goal would be that some of those cases would be filed in the Western District to help everyone get to trial more quickly and help things get resolved more quickly. I have no interest in being perceived to be a docket or a division where that is biased in favor of either party. And so what I would be pleased to be perceived of is as a court that is very fair to both sides, that understands patent law pretty well after doing it for 20 years, who had trials, I do think it's not lost on anyone that I will get people to trial pretty quickly. And given the fact that patents are in the Constitution, jury trials are in the Constitution, and that I've been blessed to be confirmed as a federal Article III judge, that I should do my very best to make the system work as well as possible. And I think getting a case to trial relatively quickly while still allowing the lawyers to develop the case adequately. I think that's a good thing and not a bad thing.
Judge, in the introduction, Judge Holt mentioned, and you've alluded to your extensive experience as a patent litigator, which, as you say, is not the norm on the federal bench. Can you give examples of ways in which that has informed how you run your courtroom? And I know you mentioned a moment ago the sufficient time to prepare invalidity contentions, for example. Are there other things that you'd like to touch upon where you were able to draw on your experience to make your court a place where people on both sides want to litigate their patent disputes?
Well, I lost $1.5 billion, which once, and to injury trial, that will certainly help educate you. I think everything I'm doing is to try and overcome the things I didn't like. So, for example, I don't have, if you personally have a dispute with opposing counsel, whether it be over the number of pages that can be printed out of source code how long a deposition can be to any issue that could be thought of in a patent litigation sense. I don't have people file motions. I have them immediately when there's a conflict that they can't resolve, contact my law clerk. And so far it's never taken me longer than 24 hours to have a hearing by phone and resolve the issue. And I try to be very patient. 2 days ago, I literally had it was between an hour and a half and 2 hour phone call, just trying to get the parties through the issue of how do we get adequate access by a plaintiff and their experts to source code in the time of COVID and adequately protect the source code. And I'm sure there are judges who would say, oh, good lawyers could just work this out. I don't see it that way. I think having court intervention, especially with someone who, like in my case, has actually seen a computer monitor sitting in my law office with source code on it, I kind of get what the issues are. And so I've done my very best to make myself accessible. I've had situations where people have called in and said, we need something resolved. And I've been on the phone with them 10 minutes later. So I try to do that. Another thing I think where we have improved, another thing that I do is I do all of my conferences that I can get away with doing remotely. When COVID hit, it was a dramatic change for me to start doing, for example, Markman hearings by Zoom. But it was not a dramatic change for me to be doing hearings by Zoom because, as I said, I was already doing all my discovery motions by Zoom. And I also did all my scheduling conferences by phone. And I was already doing all my scheduling conferences by phone. And I think that's something that lawyers also liked and appreciated. Another thing that we're doing now that I did originally to try and benefit attorneys was we now provide preliminary constructions to the lawyers the day before the Markman rather than waiting. That's important for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that I never liked the problem I had when discovery was running parallel with fights over what claim terms meant and all that. It seemed to me it was better to have that issue of law resolved early before discovery started. So in my court, with a couple of minor exceptions, discovery stayed until the Markman. But the lawyers get a final ruling on the claim constructions at the Markman, at which time discovery will start. So I know Markman is a big deal with everyone, but for me, it's really the gun going off for people to get started in their case. I have found, I think I've probably done just under COVID, I don't know, a dozen, 15, 20 Markmans, since March. And I have found in every instance where we provide preliminary constructions, it has cut my hearings in Markman's. I haven't had one that lasted more than 2 hours since I started doing that. You know, the attorneys come in, they have a general idea of what I'm thinking. I strongly encourage the attorneys at the Markman. I would encourage the attorneys on this call if they practice in front of me. And my clerks have carefully read the briefs. We've carefully gone over what the appropriate construction would be. So it is unlikely you are going to persuade me that I'm just wrong and that I ought to use the claim construction that you had offered that I rejected. But that doesn't mean that the Markman hearing is a waste of time in any way, because on probably about a third of my proposed constructions, I proffer a construction that the court has written rather than adopting one that the parties have. And so the hearing is always invaluable to me for lawyers like you to make suggestions. Judge, you have proposed the following construction for this claim term. We're 90% in agreement, but we think you ought to delete this word, or we think you should add these two words, and let us show you in the spec where that is. And I think probably in 9 out of 10 Markman hearings, I've wound up changing at least one, if not more, preliminary constructions based on what the lawyers have argued. And it's almost always been, if not always been, where the lawyer didn't try and persuade me why what they had said was correct. It's where they've come in and they've helped me make it a better preliminary construction. And I am very open-minded in any argument in that regard. So, you know, I think, again, it's been 2 years now. I've had a pretty goodly number of, I've done a lot of things now, and you just get better when you do things. And we try in each hearing to improve. You know, if anyone on this call can think of a better way than I'm doing anything, you know, I invite them to call my clerk and make a suggestion. We're constantly trying to improve what we're doing.
Well, let me turn that last question around then. In your 2 years on the bench, is there anything that you came to the court thinking you'd do as a practicing lawyer? You thought, geez, I wish the judges did it this way. And then you got to the bench, and now 2 years later, you're realizing, aha, the lawyers are wrong and the judges had it right. I'm gonna reverse course and change my view of this.
Let me tell you that I think the area where I'm most sympathetic to judges now, I was less sympathetic with before. The longer you do this, the less patience you have. But let me explain why I think that is the longer I do this, the more quickly when lawyers are making arguments, the more quickly I think I get to the end point of their argument. And so I am more, hopefully not rude, but I am more likely when I figure out where someone is going and I either have a question or want to get them there more quickly, I am much more likely in this September than I was in my first September to interrupt somebody and not let them finish a thought. And in part also, that's because what you say may spur a question that I think is important for me to help resolve something. And almost always, your being able to answer my question is more valuable to you and your client than whatever it is that you kind of can that you were about to say. So I would say I've grown more and more interactive. It's much. Let me say I'm not auditioning for the Supreme Court. Apparently, I'm not qualified in some ways to be on the current Supreme, be the next nominee. So that's not the point. But I think my style of handling hearings is much more like the Supreme Court, where the judges feel free to interrupt the lawyer to get to the point they want them to get to. And so, maybe a practice tip for the folks in the audience is, if you're going to bring a PowerPoint, I would make it a short PowerPoint, and I would never have anything more than one small point on any PowerPoint. In other words, I would use it almost as a visual outline for me, of the outline of the points that you're going to go through, because I have no patience to be having someone read to me long PowerPoints or really to have much stuff on the PowerPoint. I'm much more interactive with the lawyers. And so your PowerPoints are best when they're helping you, the lawyer, remember what it is that you're going to say and just moving to the next point. And the more quickly you move through the PowerPoint with me, the more successful you're going to be. And the more you rely on just making your argument and most importantly, answering my question and actually answering it directly. If I ask, like this morning, if I ask a question of when did something happen, I really want an answer to that rather than, well, Judge, you need to understand in this case. And then he went on for a while. He didn't go on for a long while because I interrupted him. I had a reason I had asked the question, and that's really what I wanted to hear was an answer to that question. So I probably have learned that the more time a judge has on the bench, they're getting better at knowing what you're going to say because they've heard a lot of this a lot, and they just want to move you to the conclusion and get to the point that matters to them.
Let's spend a few more moments talking about your advisory council and how your rules, your order has been generated. Have you had instances in the past couple of years where maybe you've disagreed with your counsel or you've hashed anything out that you can share with us? It's like, how's the sausage being made, as they say about democracy and legislation?
I'll give you, I think, an exact example. There's nothing being hashed out because I don't hashed out in the sense you might mean, like where there are competing interests and I'm trying to resolve it like legislation. What I'm trying to do is decide what's, I've got really two constituencies here. One is the lawyers and their clients, but the other is my court. And what I mean by that is for a big example would be, you know, how many pages should I allow people to have in briefs? You know, the more generous I am with lawyers, the greater burden I place on myself and my staff. And at some point, it's counterintuitive maybe, but at some point, it's not good for lawyers to have more than less if it's more than we can do. But a real specific example is I go back and forth in my head all the time whether or not we need to have with Markman's and some other motions, but whether or not we need to have reply briefs. I understand the reasons why they may be a very good idea. I understand, you know, the fact that sometimes the plaintiff may not raise a real issue until they file their response, and the reply gives the defendant an opportunity to respond to that. On the other hand, it's one more round of paper for us to review, and I don't know. A lot of times what's in the reply is simply a regurgitation of what we've already heard in the response. And don't forget, I'm going to have a Markman hearing. So if there's a point that could be made in a reply, the lawyers will have an opportunity to make it in a Markman. I don't put time limits on the Markmans. But I understand, having practiced law in that area for 20 years, that there are people who are willing to die on a hill to keep the replies, and there are people who are don't carry the way, and there are people who think it'd be easier. My law clerks would love it if we didn't have replies. And so I try and figure out overall you know, what will work best for everybody. Knowing there's no magic bullet, there's no perfect answer. I'm really just trying in every revision to do it better and to listen to counsel like you who have input and give me thoughts about how things can be improved, how words can be improved, whatever I can do, to make how I'm handling things more efficient or the procedural rules better. I'm always all ears.
You mentioned earlier that a couple of your goals are certainty and fairness and speed to resolution. As your caseload has increased, is that putting stress on those goals? Is it affecting how recent amendments to your standard order have come to be? Do you anticipate problems in the future, especially on the certainty and the speed goal in light of the caseload?
I think maybe on the very edges, yes, but no. For example, starting in September, I got a fourth clerk. I think there is at least a possibility I will be getting another magistrate judge early 22. I think we're fine. I've been able to get just extraordinarily great talent in terms of who I've hired. You know, right now, I think there's no one who's been in my court in the last year who doesn't know Dr. Josh. He is one of my clerks. The clerk that's replacing him in January is going to be equally beloved in a quick manner. I have another law clerk that will be starting in August, who spent, I think, a dozen years as a patent examiner before going back to law school and is now at a patent litigation firm, and they're going to loan them to me for a year. So, you know, we've got people working here. And by the way, I'm still a lawyer. So, you know, when stuff comes in, I'm able to work on a lot of it as well and be involved and help get things done. So I think will it be perfect? Will there be months when we have a problem getting every trial in, like happens in Marshall and other places? Sure, but by and large, I anticipate things going pretty well.
If we can, let's take a step, back or step to a higher level and talk a bit about the policy behind not just your standing order, but local patent rules in general. You know, there are districts, well-known patent districts, like the Eastern District of Virginia, the Western District of Wisconsin, that developed reputations for being very fast with few, if any, rules. And then, of course, there's other districts like the Northern District of California and the Eastern District of Texas that sort of pioneered the local patent rule movement that was followed then by some of the bigger cities. Did you consider going the no rules route? Did you consider some other approach? How did you get to where we are today?
I'll tell you, I'm probably in that sense. The answer is no. I should answer your question too. I broke my own rule. The answer is no. But with the exception, I think I'm right, with the exception of a trademark case I had in Virginia, I never had a case, and I had one case in Wisconsin only. And I didn't like the way, how stuff worked there very well. It didn't work. And so in terms of the speed and some other things, I didn't have a lot of experience with those. I had a lot of experience in the Eastern District, had a lot of experience in the Southern District of California. And, I went into it pretty well thinking that local patent rules were the way to go. And what was more important to me was coming up with not just rules that worked for the court, but rules that worked well for the attorneys too. I'm not saying that that's not true of other places. Like I said, I thought, you know, I love being in the Eastern District of Texas, for example, because I got so familiar with the rules and how things work. But I, you know, but at the same time, you know, I've enjoyed coming up with my own set of rules. I've enjoyed working with lawyers and getting their input. And I think, again, the very largest reason for people having the faith to file in the Western District with me, I think is at least partially a result of that.
In recent months, the PTAB, when deciding whether or not to institute an IPR, has used its discretion to deny institution in light of the proximity of trial in a pending district court case, the speed of the docket in that case. I think at least one of those PTAB decisions was a case that was co-pending in your courtroom. Does the IPR process impact your thinking on rules? Does the idea that the PTAB may even deny institution if the case is already pending in a fast court, does that impact your thinking?
No. I'll tell you what impacts my thinking. The way I handle my docket would be exactly the identical way I would handle it if there were no PTAB process. Now, that's slightly not true in a handful of circumstances. For example, I think I had one case where a plaintiff had filed several cases in another state, I think it's California. And then a fairly long time after that, they filed some cases in my court and the same patents. And by the time they filed in my court, the IPR process was fairly long in the tooth. And my facts are a little shady, but I don't even think I could have had the Markman before they had tried and resolved the case in the PTAB. That wouldn't have made any sense for me to move forward. With the exception of that situation, my view of patent litigation is really the PTAB is going to do whatever they do. I have no impact on it. I have no involvement in it. I don't even pay attention to it. What I care about very much, and this is the way I felt before I went on the bench. Patents are provided for in the Constitution. Juries are provided for in the Constitution. I was unbelievably blessed for the president to nominate me and the Senate to confirm me to be a federal judge who presides over federal cases that include patent cases. My goal is to get all of my cases resolved, and not all my patent cases. My goal is to get all of my cases resolved as quickly as I can. So if you do that inversely, all cases would include patent cases. It's not the other way around. And so, I set up my system because I think the way I've set out the procedures, which is staying discovery until the Markman. I think I give a fair amount of time for people to prepare for the Markman. Everyone can ask for more time if they think they need it because of their case. It gives parties the opportunity before the Markman to do infringement contentions and invalidity contentions. It gives them the opportunity if they want it. It's rare that they take it, but they could certainly have experts if they wanted to, or they could depose the inventor if they wanted to. And like I said, and there's no discovery. I've limited the cost of the litigation, I think, pretty substantially. I think 8 months is more than fair. If people need more time, they could certainly get it. If they could persuade me why it was they needed it. I think I tried a bunch of these cases. I think having 12 to 16 months to prepare a patent case is plenty of time. And again, when I'm setting the trial, I'm not a dictator. Although I've certainly been in front of people who at my job who were, but I'm not a dictator. I invite lawyers to tell me why the case might not be able to be prepared within the normal period of time I have. I've tried to be as logical as possible. I have a case coming up for trial where we decided that the number of patents was too, in my opinion, substantial to have only one trial. I think we figured the trial would probably last 3 or 4, maybe more weeks than that. So I divided the case up into 3 trials. I don't think anyone was overly happy about that, but I thought it was the fairest way. It was the fairest thing for the jury to only have a certain number of patents in any one particular case and expect them to really be able to handle it. So I am, I think having rules and having predictability is extremely important, but there isn't a single rule that I have that isn't open to amendment if an attorney can give me a reason to do it. I'll give you an example. I handle these cases. I remember a case where we had a problem getting some art. I don't remember exactly why, but I remember the art was located in either a library or a college in Germany. And it was just, we knew it was there, but we were having a really hard time getting access to it. If someone comes to me on the first day of the lawsuit and says, "Judge, we know ordinarily discovery doesn't start, but we predict this could be a specific problem. Can we start working right now to get access to that so it won't delay the process of the trial?" Then the answer is going to be yes, because the rules are not there to prevent people from being able to prosecute or defend their case. They're there to help me handle them in an orderly manner. So all the way back to your question, though, the IPR is an independent avenue of relief. It doesn't impact me. My goal is to make sure that if a party files a patent case in my court, that it will be resolved in as fair a way as possible, and it will be resolved, relatively speaking, in a period of time that I think is good for the system.
Well, this is Judge Holt. Not to take myself off mute and drop in your conversation like my son's afternoon time with Sesame Street and Big Bird coming into things, but just wanted to make sure that I do lay out a question for Art regarding his 2012 Engage article that's linked on the Teleforum website titled "Local Patent Rules, Certainty and Efficiency, or a Crazy Quilt of Substantive Law." So with the policy discussion now regarding local rules, I guess, Art, can you tell us a little bit about your article and for a couple minutes of discussion on the legal foundation for local patent rules?
Sure, and this will lead into my next question for Judge Albright. The article I wrote was inspired by working on a case that was transferred from one court to another with seemingly similar patent rules, but a very different interpretation of some of those rules. And you can get the same thing when you move from a court without rules to a court with rules and vice versa. And so I started looking into the legal basis for local patent rules. And it starts with the Rules Enabling Act in 1934. The Congress empowered the Supreme Court to make the federal rules of civil procedure that we work with today. There's a rule of civil procedure that empowers courts to adopt local rules. And the concern at the time, and I think the concern still today, is that those rules be relatively uniform across the country, not change the substantive, the underlying substantive law, and not be so different that they encourage forum shopping. In other instances, I think, in here in our conversation with Judge Albright, we're talking about his standing order. So it's slightly different than a local rule, but I suspect the goal of uniformity still applies, and there's a balance, there's a tension between uniformity, but the certainty and the efficiency that each court is seeking, you know, in light of its local circumstances. So my question back to Judge Albright then is, you know, how much do you consider what's going on in other courts as you tweak your order? You know, how far are you, you know, I guess, are there things that you've thought about doing and rejected because you thought, well, that might make me such an outlier that it goes beyond the spirit of what I should be doing in my own courtroom? Or is the balance, is certainty and efficiency, you know, so valuable to lawyers? And, you know, I certainly appreciate that as a practicing lawyer, that it outweighs the downside of having some differences.
No, I've never thought about it that way. I guess I've always felt that, in a sense, I've been as democratic with a small d as possible in the way I've done this, in having the involvement of a committee of the constituents. And so, you know, I guess in the end, they are my it's my order, obviously, but I don't think there's anything. I think I'm also the person, I'll make suggestions for improvements. I will give the final approval to whatever improvements are made. But really what I'm operating under, it reflects the constituency of lawyers who are most likely to be in my court doing patent cases. And also, maybe something else, hopefully, that is keeping it from the concern that you may have expressed in terms of something being provincial. My committee is not made up of just Western District lawyers. The committee is made up, has lawyers from many states, and it continues. It also includes, as I understand it, in-house counsel. And so, again, it is completely voluntary to join, and I think I've done my best to give people access to any specific concern that they might have. I don't know how many federal judges get complaints, probably not many, but let me frame it more artfully. I don't get a lot of suggestions. If something comes up, it's usually me when I realize something unintended has happened, and I might just want to clarify what I said. So it's really an effort. Yes, it helps me. It dramatically helps me. My schedule is very easy to follow for me, but I think it's also. It's what's best for it's what's best for the lawyers who are practicing in my court.
Well, I think we're getting close to the question and answer time period, so I'd like to conclude by asking a question. And forgive me, it's probably a compound question, but do you see what do you see in terms of future trends for patent litigation? Do you see look down the road and do you see certain trends emerging, and do you have ideas as to how those trends may impact both your courtroom and patent litigation generally?
I'll tell you, I think what will be fascinating to me is how we integrate the Zoom process that we were sort of forced to take on. I can't imagine if you had come to me in January and said, Judge, you know, I don't really want to go to Waco, or, you know, I'm in New York, don't want to go to the Markman. Can we just do it by Zoom? I don't think I would have even, I probably would have laughed. Now, I think there are some real upsides to doing some hearings by Zoom. And I think if lawyers felt that, that Zoom hearings would be sufficient. They're certainly less expensive. I had a pretrial hearing 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago where I think the clients on one side were from Holland or somewhere in Europe, and they were able to attend by Zoom. I think another great thing that Zoom is allowing us to do is, for example, my Markman tomorrow will be by Zoom. My law clerk tells me we have 20 claim terms, which is more than we should. But I've seen a couple of them. I think it would be great if the law firm, one law firm or the other or both, said, we're not paying any additional money to let one of our younger or less experienced lawyers travel with us. We'll let that lawyer handle a couple of claim terms to give them an opportunity to speak to the court that might otherwise not be available to them because, you know, it just wouldn't work to have them, you know, travel a day and travel a day back just to, you know, get 10 minutes on their feet. But I think the integration of technology in the way we handle things going forward could be really awesome. I'm 99.9% sure I will never have a jury trial by Zoom, but I would have thought in February I wouldn't even consider a bench trial by Zoom, and now I would at least be open to it. And so I think I think the COVID, you know, horrors that we've gone through, which are all regrettable, I think it opened up our eyes a little bit, though, that there are other ways of doing things I don't think any judge would have thought of before. You know, who would have ever thought we would have the Supreme Court hearing arguments by, you know, by teleconference? You know, just pretty amazing stuff.
Well, thank you so much for an excellent discussion, Judge Albright and Art. With that, Nick has already announced how to dial in from your keypad with questions. Nick, we're ready to go to audience questions now. Do you want to go ahead and lead us into our first questioner?
Okay, let's get our first questioner on the line. Hi, Judge Albright. I was curious to get your sense for, it seems like you've litigated a lot of cases both in the Eastern District and the Western District of Texas, and I believe not many cases have gone to trial yet in your court, if I'm not mistaken. And I'm wondering if you have any general impressions of the differences or similarities between the jury pools in the Eastern District on the one hand, the Western District on the other. I think, as by way of background, a lot of litigators believe that the Eastern District has relatively favorable juries to patent holders. And the thought is, at least so I've heard, is the Western District might be materially different in that regard, and that makes sense considering that it includes Austin. But I'm curious to hear what your impressions are, both as a litigator and as a judge.
Thank you for the question. Could you introduce yourself as well, quick?
Oh, sure. I'm Nathan Lowenstein, a patent litigator in Los Angeles.
Great. Thank you, Nathan. Judge Albright?
Well, let me tell you, as a patent trial lawyer, I won several cases on the plaintiff side in Austin, and I won cases on the defense side in Eastern District of Texas. So, I'm less persuaded that either of the things you said are correct. And what I mean by that is, I think if you've got a good case on the defense side in Eastern District, you can win. I think if you've got a good case in the Western District, you'll be successful as a plaintiff. At a higher level, I think, you know, what's interesting about, I'll focus on my division. I tried a bunch of cases. I'm not sure that I would rather be a plaintiff or a defendant in the Waco division, in that, I've tried a bunch of non-patent cases. My first patent trial starts a week from Monday here. But, you know, you've got a really interesting mix in the 11 counties in Waco. At a high level, I think it might compare maybe to Tyler. And by that, I mean, you know, there's a good university in Tyler. You've got Baylor in Waco. You've got a big medical center in Tyler. You've got a big medical center in Waco. You have certainly what you might call some rural or blue collar counties in Waco, but you do in Tyler as well. So I don't think I would, if I were selecting between the Eastern Division of Texas and the Western Division of Texas, I don't think I would be basing it, you know, on a perception of what the juries that they would lean one way or the other. I don't think you get that. You especially don't get that in Austin, where I also will have a couple of trials. Where in Austin you have 17 counties, and Travis County, which is where Austin sits, is only one of the 17. And you go 170 miles west, and that's as rural as, you know, you can be. And it's not East Texas rural, it's West Texas rural. So, you know, you've got Williamson County to the north and Hayes to the south. Those can be fairly conservative counties. So, you know, I'm less persuaded that that there is a leaning of the jury pool in one direction or the other in either of the districts.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that answer and excellent question. Nick, I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, we'll go to one more now.
Hi, Judge Albright. My name is Matt Moderman. I'm the Akron Law Federal Society president, going to clerk for Judge Ryan Holt in August of next year, and then be a patent litigator for Jones Day in Cleveland thereafter. My question for you, after hearing you talk so much about how great your patent law clerks are, I'm curious to know what characteristics they have or what it is they do specifically that makes them so great in your eyes.
I think you said how my law clerks, you cut out for a second. What makes my law
clerks? Yeah, I'm curious to know what.
You know, there's a special sauce in law clerks. You know, I think they reflect kind of the way the judge acts in terms of demeanor and how hard they work and all that. I'm unbelievably blessed. The way I pick my law clerks, for example, I reserve one of my clerk positions for one of the top people at Baylor Law School because I'm sitting in Waco. And so far, Baylor has not let me down. They have sent me two or three of their number one students in a row. So academically, they come over super prepared. Next, I would say, you know, with my technical law clerk, he has a PhD in double E. He worked as an engineer before he went to law school. He worked as a patent litigator for 10 years. And so, you know, and the law clerk I'm getting to replace that law clerk in January is currently a patent litigator. And I think whenever you get a law clerk who, for me, when you get a law clerk who understands not only what the arguments are that the lawyers are making, but really the why they're making them, the end game that the lawyers are trying to accomplish by making the arguments, then you have, you know, really great law clerks. Other than that, it's just, you know, like anything else, you know, we all work really hard. Every one of my law clerks has a gazillion things to do, and somehow they manage to get them all done and still be nice to me. So that's, I think figuring out, getting as simpatico as quickly as possible with your judge about how he likes things done is an incredibly important thing to do.
And I'll just add, of course, attending the teleforums that they participate in.
Right.
Well, Nick, I think, does that end our time?
Well, we've got one question in the queue. Do we?
Okay, great. Yeah, let's just go one more question. Please introduce yourself before asking.
Hi, Judge Albright. David Emerson here. I'm a patent practitioner in Berkeley, California. Just a question about what your plans are to sort of market the efforts that you've made and the results of your creating standing orders and local rules in your court to try to seed those to pollinate them into other courts, whether it be through some kind of a boot camp program for incoming judges or some other mechanism. Have you given any thoughts and what do you think about that?
Most judges I have found don't have very much interest in asking other judges how to do things. What I'm finding is probably the way I am cross-pollinating is, for example, I was recently on a call on a panel discussion like this with three other judges, and one of them is in a venue that has a pretty substantial patent docket. And at the end of the call, when that judge heard how I handled different things and the benefits of them, called me and said, "Hey, that all sounds interesting. Can we chat? And can you have your clerk send me stuff?" So I think probably the way I'll do it, I try and attend a fair number of these kind of. I've never said no when anyone's asked me to attend one of these type of events, primarily because if I have other judges on the panel, I inevitably learn something I wouldn't have thought of doing. And so I find it very beneficial and educational for me. And hopefully other judges will hear what I'm doing and think that that might benefit them as well to do what they're doing.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for the question. And I believe that brings an end to our teleforum today. Judge Albright, thank you so much for participating, and as well as Art, we really appreciate your time. This was an excellent discussion. Nick, is there anything else for the panel?
Well, thank you all. Thanks for taking a few extra minutes, especially Judge Albright. We appreciate your time. And I'll just say on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our three speakers today and our audience for calling in this afternoon. We welcome listener feedback, your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. We check this regularly, so if you've got some feedback, let us know. And as always, keep an eye on our website and on your emails for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls and soon announcements about our virtual National Lawyers Convention this fall. So thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.